Hello everyone, and thank you for tuning in. This is Stefan again, this time with Doug Roberts. And I think with an episode especially relevant for everyone who wants to understand the US education system better, edtech startups trying to break into the US education market, but also policymakers who want to get inspired and see how the United States have evolved over the years and want to learn about the current state of edtech, but also about how procurement and purchasing decisions in edtech are being done by district leaders. And because I've been interested in this topic, I've asked a lot of people whom I could talk to, and they all pointed me into one direction, to Doug Roberts from the Institute for Education Innovation. Hi, Doug.
Hey, how are you? That's quite an intro. If they're pointing to me, I don't know what that says about the rest of us.
They say there's someone who works for both sides, district leaders and also edtech companies, and who understands very well how these two parties can come together. So, Doug, you need to tell us about what you do now.
Yeah, sure. Okay. I guess that is what we aim to do. We aim to bridge a gap in the conversations around innovation. I have worked with many just incredible district leaders over the years who I see working their tails off to try to find the best, most creative and innovative solution to problems. And then I have worked with several entrepreneurs and founders of organizations who are similarly working to provide creative and innovative solutions to challenges. And it can be hard for them to find each other, partially because our process of buying and selling in K-12 is somewhat antiquated. And so we're trying to use the old school methods of building relationships, getting together in a room, getting to know each other, getting to learn what makes each other tick, and what makes our systems and organizations tick, but applying kind of innovation to that old school connection process, specifically around analytics, providing matches based on driven by district needs, so that if we create a robust and sort of level playing field, democratized ecosystem where any company or nonprofit or other organization, regardless of its size, experience, influence, investor backing or not, can have access to districts that are trying to solve the problem that they're working on. And if districts don't have to work through kind of sort of antiquated systems of finding their way to solutions, whether it's through the sales rep they've known for 20 years or whomever's buying lunch at the local superintendent, county superintendent meeting, then we can get more of these ideas implemented in more districts and get more solutions provided at better price points for districts across the country. That's sort of the idea. And, you know, we're just trying to, it's an old school gathering with a lot of kind of innovation built around it and how we put those meetings together.
Yeah, if I check out one of your meetings, the agenda, it is an offline meeting. It's a real meeting. It's
in person. Yeah. But during pandemics, when the, you know, numbers were raging and schools were hybrid or virtual, we were doing some hybrid stuff, but no, this, and that worked during the time, but these are in-person gatherings and they are, but there's work that happens before and after to set up the opportunity for two people to sit down, two leaders, a district leader and an organization leader, for 25 minutes to have a chat about what it is that the district's trying, what problem the district's trying to solve, and what solution the provider is offering. And then they can try to figure out if there's a fit, and then maybe a business relation comes about afterwards. The most important thing about this, why this works, is that our district leaders buy into it as one of their learning opportunities throughout the year. So they come to IEI because they know that the people they meet with are not going to give them some kind of crazy sales pitch or beat them over the head with aggressive, you know, like salesy stuff. It's more like, hey, this is what we do. If you want, and this, so our superintendents go, I need to learn about, we need to get better at these three categories of work. And there's a menu of providers here who are in those categories. So I'm going to sit and talk with them and I'm going to learn from them. And I'm going to bring that learning back to my district. It's not about necessarily doing business. It's about learning what's out there and then figuring out how we can improve what we're currently doing. Many of our members will go back and develop in-house or offline solutions based on a conversation with one of our partners. Others go, wow, I didn't know this was even possible. Yeah. And kind of, you know, probe with them. Can you integrate with this? Are you aligned with that? And, you know, why don't you come and talk to my team? And then let the team make the decision about whether they're going to do business with the provider or not. The superintendents are unique people in our system because they see all the different angles to work in a district. Almost all of them have been teachers. Many of them have been principals. Most of them have been parents. And all of us, of course, have been students. But these are the folks who've also sat in the public meetings. They've taken the slings and arrows from the public when things are tough. They've received the praise when things go well. They've dealt with elected officials, their bosses, the Board of Education. Board members come in and out. They understand the procurement process. They've been through this current rash of federal funding from ESSER. They've been through the times when the feds weren't supporting their work as much, and they know how to navigate all of these situations. And so the superintendent is the right place to start the conversation. The problem is that the superintendent is the hardest person to reach in a school district because of the massive, you know, operations they have to run. We don't give enough credit in the States, I think, to the business acumen of school superintendents. If you had somebody running a, you know, $5 billion budget or a, you know, $50 million budget or a $350 million, you know, most districts are in the hundreds of millions in their budget. Many are in the billions. And these are complex operations with thousands of people reporting into them. And so for them to be able to run that school system, but also drill in, because the chief academic officer says, we've got to improve our early literacy, so they can drill in with a few of our solution providers around early literacy, for example, and bring back a few options. That's pretty remarkable stuff. And it's the entrepreneurial kind of aspect of superintendent work that we try to kind of help people understand that is a big part of their jobs.
What I like about the events, when I look at a typical agenda, is that there's not only ed tech talk, but there's also this idea of superintendents meeting each other again and again over time. So there's this camaraderie, this group that forms this, maybe even a kind of club. You actually get to meet people who have to go through the same stuff like you as a superintendent in their district every day. And this must create amazing learning opportunities, because suddenly there's peer-to-peer learning for people who usually have no peers because they're on the very top of the hierarchy, right?
Yeah, it's yes. So the keynote speaker at IEI is usually us. It's the members. And I think that's why people keep coming back, the learning from each other. When we get together, we typically don't sit in an audience with a person at a lectern looking at PowerPoints. We typically sit in a big circle or oval, and we go around the room and we ask everybody to come and share, you know, there's a topic. So the next one is student safety and security. We're asking everybody to show up to this gathering in November with a few things you're trying to get better at in safety and security, which is going to look different in every district.
Yeah.
You're going to have some districts that are trying to increase strategies around mental health and assessing student mental health. You have other places that are, you know, we're starting to think about hardening the school a little bit and thinking about draconian measures like metal detectors and all that, but we don't want to scare everybody. Who has ideas, right? You just show up and you tell everybody what you're working on, and you can be vulnerable with our group and let them know kind of what you're struggling with and what you're working on. And that's sort of the beauty of the experience and the learning process and learning opportunity. But it truly is, it's a community of people who are curious and engaged in trying to get better at what they do. You know, it's sort of like, you know, a book club, right? It's all people who really want to learn more about this specific book, or, you know, we call it a think tank or sort of society of you know, district leaders who are looking to learn and grow from each other and bring their colleagues in who they think, you know, would add to our ability to learn. That's one of the things I say when I'm talking to superintendents who are considering joining us. I always say, I hope you'll join us because we would really love to learn from you over the course of this year. And that's what it's about. It's a really remarkable group of individuals.
Yeah, what very much strikes me is that you can create this trust instantly among people who are not competing with each other because they work in their own region. That you can scale this in a series of events. So you productize trust and peer-to-peer learning in a fantastic way that very much makes everyone benefit here. I think that's absolutely amazing. Was there something that inspired you to do it this way? Some role model organization that you've looked at and said, okay, I could do this for district leaders?
Yeah, so I want to say one thing about competitive. Yes, they're not competitive with each other. However, wellness is a big part of what we do. When we get our members out of district, we want to make sure they have opportunities to focus on their own kind of wellness. And a lot of that ends up being, you know, none of us exercise enough, right? None of us get enough time outside. And so when we are together and we have this group, we tend to put on some sort of either athletic sports event or a game show type event, and you want to see competitive. They may not be competitive with each other around their work as soups, but we put them all on a basketball court last April at our spring summit. It was intense and fun. And, you know, I've never seen a group of people who sat in a room all day talking about how we have to be equitable for all kids and everybody gets a chance, then get on a basketball court and want nothing of the sort because they wanted their team to win the trophy. And that's what's fun about the group. And, you know, we're competitive when it comes to fun and play. And I think that helped everybody relax and get a little kind of mental break. Because this is a grueling job. And it's a grueling job that's in the public light and you're in the newspaper. And if you say the wrong thing in a meeting, people get very upset. And that's a lot of pressure, especially when you get into it because you care about kids and you think you're one of the people who has the skill set to potentially be good at this very hard job, and kids need somebody who has the skill set to do the job. And so, you know, everyone I know who does this job in our group, at least, comes at it from a perspective of service, and that makes the job harder. But it helps you get through the tough times when it does get difficult, which is why we give the outlet of, you know, these kind of fun wellness activities. And yeah, we do morning workouts and bike rides, and yeah, we work hard, play hard. We make it a short event. And your question was about where we got the ideas. Honestly, we put this together based on talking with superintendents and some of the folks who lead ed tech companies, not just tech, but education companies. There's some, you know, low or non-tech providers in our group. And we just said, you know, what do you think one of these, what would get you to come to something? Hmm. And we got major themes from the discussions when I was getting this started. For the superintendent side, they said, keep all the meetings short. Give me opportunity to listen to my colleagues in addition to the work we do with the partners. Let me choose on the partner side. Let me choose who I meet with. Let me know everyone who's there very quickly. Don't expect me to do pre-work. Let me show up and dive in and, you know, make the food decent and give us some time to, you know, just do recreational stuff together. So, you know, I started this because there wasn't anything that quite did all of this. And so, but I would say that, you know, there have been gatherings of district leaders in the past. So I think we certainly stand on the shoulders of those giants, even though we do this differently. You know, I think to some extent, you know, they're national, the national superintendent organization in the States. And by the way, anybody listening to this is looking to work the stage should consider going to the AASA event. It's in February this year. It's in San Antonio, I think February 16th. You know, we're essentially trying to provide them with a complement to that national AASA experience where, you know, something like a third, 40%, I don't know what the actual number is of the nation's superintendents go to that event. And it's a huge event, right? And so we're the kind of small think tank type event. And if I have to, you know, other things we've modeled it after, I would say the community aspect of it has been modeled after kind of, you know, any club. You know, we have a ton of people who in our group who were involved in fraternities in college, and they maintain those relationships, you know, throughout their adult lives. And I think that the the bond between those kinds of groups. Those of us who've been to university and been part of those groups, I think we've modeled our group a little bit after that. The idea that you can get referred in by one of the members. We don't really turn people away if they're really interested in us. They come check us out and we usually let them in as long as their board of ed is okay with it. But I think those relationships that have become lifelong, that have provided value to people over the course of their lives, I think that's, if anything, the model we've tried to put together here, is that if we deliver really strong relationships to people, and you know, these relationships, it doesn't matter if you're a partner or a district leader, some of the friendships in this group are just friendships. There are a lot of them. A lot of our folks have maybe never done business together, but you know, they're getting together at somebody's lake house if they're driving through, you know, on a summer vacation with their kids, and it's like, come on over, let's spend time. Like, that's, the relationships are much more important than the business. But if you go and build the relationships, and if you listen and take the right approach, the business comes.
Who knows how many people you inspire to do this in their home country around the world right now? Because this mix of bringing people together who definitely have a need to talk on the one hand, and on the other hand, having someone sponsor the event who is in some sort of innovative field where it is really about learning and understanding. You know, you're not asking the furniture industry in school to sponsor you, because you know they could also be interested in district leaders,
sure,
because they want to bring their furniture to schools. Or you're not asking the lunch caterers to sponsor this, but you're doing it in a certain field where there's the most movement at the moment, at the most insecurity.
Yeah, but there's room for the lunch caterers here if they want to mm-hmm. come and get engaged in, you know, like a discussion about what the future of school lunches should look like, right?
True.
Because there's a whole discussion to have there around, like, does everybody feel that their culture is represented in the school lunch that's provided? You know, should we be spending more on lunches to provide healthier foods? So they're welcome as well. But yeah, a lot of the companies are, you know, we think we have a way to improve, you know, this aspect of the work that's really challenging. What do you think? Let's talk about how. And then it becomes a dialogue. I think my district might be interested in this. Can you do this? Can you do that? Can you give it to me for this? You know, they get into the business discussion, but it starts with the work and the idea. And so, you know, if folks in other countries are thinking about doing this, I would say, first of all, we do have a unique thing here in the fact that our schools are governed by local boards of education who hire a superintendent who then run a school system, versus, you know, several companies like the UK elsewhere. Each individual school is a unit reporting into a national ministry. So I think that there's a very different mindset. You know, a soup is like a chief executive. A principal is a little bit more of a manager. I don't mean that to put principals down, mm-hmm. but it's a different, like, superintendents have to be over these large bureaucracies and budgets and organizations and civil servants. And, you know, they can be very complex organizations. We all kind of know what a school looks like, and it's not that it's easy work, but it's a very different sales process to sell at the school level than at the district level. And there are a lot of companies in the States who just work at the school level, and they fan out with people in every state who work with individual schools, and that's great. And that's particularly curriculum stuff tends to get sold that way here. But anything that's kind of enterprise level, you really need the district leadership team on board, and that's where we help.
So what's the sweet spot? Like, what edtech companies would profit most from your offer? If you say that curriculum is rather a school-to-school kind of door-to-door sales thing, then what is more a district? What happens on district level?
It's not that curriculum folks don't come to IEI. They do. It's just there is a lot of curriculum that is bought and sold at the school level. There are plenty of places in the States where districts don't drive curriculum decisions. They leave it to particularly our larger cities like New York City. Individual schools are given a budget and, you know, funds, and then they go procure the stuff that they want at their local schools. Yeah, the diversity and the learning needs at the different schools around a big place like New York City is great. But, you know, your smaller districts tend to make district-wide decisions on curriculum. And so there's a team typically. Curriculum is probably the most... it's one of the things that gets procured you know, with the most kind of cooks in the kitchen, if you will. They usually want teachers involved, and that, you know, a lot of our members, they have a process. We've gone over it on our podcast on Education Thought Leaders, a process where a teacher can propose something to the principal, who can propose it to the district. You know, we're using this thing in our classroom that we found on our own. We'd like you to take a look at this, and maybe we can get some volume discounts if you buy at the district level. It's a very democratic with a lowercase d buying process for a lot of solutions, particularly stuff that is, you know, at that intersection of teaching and learning where teachers are working with kids. So I would say your question, you know, you can't come to IEI and just think about profit. What you want to think about is growing your organization and growing your relationships. And the profit will come. So if you, you know, because some people will, if you come in with that mentality, then that those are the people who, when they go into our matching process, will only choose the largest districts. And if you just choose the largest districts, you're not finding the best fit. And so if you come to the States, be prepared to work with districts of all sizes and shapes. And if you find that there are a couple of districts in rural Iowa who really get what you're doing, find a way to work with them, because two districts in rural Iowa can easily turn into 25 over the course of a year or so. And so I think the companies that do best come in with a focus on listening, on building relationships, and on working the problem. So if you're a solution in search of a problem, that's going to be tough. If you know that there's a problem and you're looking at the problem and trying to provide a solution to it, our members will see that, identify it, and then try to work with you to figure out how you can solve the problem on the ground in their place. So I don't think there's any type of company that is better or less suited to an IEI. As long as you're working at the district enterprise level, we can help you.
And how would the process continue until there's some purchasing decision once, and let's say, an EdTech leader has met a district leader and they felt that this is a very good fit?
Yeah, so it goes any number of different directions. Sometimes, you know, so we have these 25-minute one-to-one meetings. And not all of the partnerships that get built come out of those one-to-one meetings. Sometimes it happens, you know, on the basketball court or over lunch or over dinner. But, you know, something happens where the district leader says, all right, well, this is something we're working on. It's timely. Usually what it is I'm going to get you set up. Send me an email tomorrow on your way home. I'm going to forward it to the person on my team who leads this work. And I'm going to make sure that you meet with that person and her team. And you just let me know if I can help with anything. But really, you know, I'm going to stay out of this. And I'm going to let my team make the decision. So essentially, in most of the partnerships that come out of IEI, the soup is kind of the triage, the filter, the you know, the lead gen for the team that's trying to solve the problem. And so the superintendent, she or he, hands this over to a team and says, look, I found these folks through my relationship with IEI. If you're interested, I think they can be helpful. And a lot of times they'll even say, and if we need to fit into a budget line, I can probably negotiate a deal with them. You know, that's part of the process. Our members and our partners tend to, you know, it's the relationship here and the vetting that happens to even get inside of our meeting tends to build trust, so that if a vendor partner, you know, has a district say, can you give me 25% off on this for the first year? They typically tend to kind of be flexible and work those kinds of relationships, because it's the relationship and the long play that matters. So that's the typical way it happens. But I'll tell you, I'm walking around checking in on our one-to-one meetings, and I'll see a superintendent on his phone, and I'm thinking, you know, why are you texting during the meeting? And I'll sort of say, hey, how are you doing? And it's, oh, I'm texting my facilities director. I want her to meet with these people next week. You know, so it sometimes happens in real time. We've actually had a few where they committed, you know, verbally committed to doing work together right on the site of our meeting. And then other times it can take a lot longer. We have some districts where, you know, we have members who say, you know what, I'm not interested in the objections that my team is going to bring. I know we need to do this for kids, so I'm just going to make sure we do it. And And then we have others where they say, you know, sorry, my team doesn't want to do this and I have to go with them, even though I think it's the right call. Stay in touch with me and let's see what happens. Let's see if their plan A works out, right? Because it's a long relationship. And then 6 months later, we're together and they're like, guess what? Plan A didn't work out. Now my team's ready for plan B. I got to get you back in there. So it's a long, it can be a long sales cycle here in the States. It can be 6 to 12, 18 months to get your district-wide partnership going. But the renewal rates are so high. And, you know, if you do a good job, districts tend to be pretty loyal and tend to work with you until, you know, either something goes wrong, their needs change, or the big thing that happens a lot that can be tough is when a smaller company gets bought by a larger company, and then the customer service can fall. Sometimes it goes great, but sometimes the customer service kind of falls off the ledge and all the people you built your original relationship with are now gone and have gone on to work elsewhere. And then the partnership can fizzle. But, you know, usually that's at least a 3 or 4 year relationship that delivers value for everyone involved.
For those who are not so familiar with the structure underneath the superintendent, can you, I know it's complex, but can you name a few roles that typically Sure. work for a superintendent?
All right. So your typical district of, let's take 20,000 students, which is, it's not the mean of, you know, the mean is somewhere in the single thousands of districts in the States, but 20,000, there are a lot of 20,000 student districts and they tend to be, a good mix of, you know, some volume, but still, you know, not too complicated to work with. So you've got a cabinet in those districts. There's a chief, sometimes deputy of instruction. There's usually one for student services, which is where we house things like special education and mental health and social work and all that kind of stuff. There's usually somebody who does facilities. There's usually somebody who does athletics, and that person is often also responsible for the curriculum in phys ed, sometimes not. There's usually a chief for finance. There may be a chief for public relations. There could be a separate chief for special education, separate from student services. Sometimes it's in the same place. And all of these, you know, Oh, and then there's usually counsel, you know, a lawyer or two. And, you know, those folks all report into the soup. The soup reports to the Board of Ed. The counsel, the lawyer usually reports to the Board of Ed and the superintendent, sometimes just to the Board of Ed. Sometimes the financial person, depending on the state, reports directly to the board versus to the superintendent. So those folks then have team, like the curriculum person will have, you know, usually one for each of the core subjects. A math person, a language arts, science, social studies, and then someone else who does all the specials. An arts and music person, a tech, college career readiness. So, you know, there's usually an organization that fans out under that superintendent to kind of run the district. And there's usually a big district office, right? And then but in larger districts, you'll have somebody who is like a head of schools, and that person manages all the principals. In the 20,000 student district, typically the principals all report into the superintendent. In a smaller district, you can have superintendents who are also principals. You can have a superintendent who just manages five principals, and then there's a small team of curriculum. You know, there's like a curriculum and student services person and an athletics and facilities. You know, it can be kind of merged. But in your smaller districts, you're more likely to see superintendents get involved in a lot of the different aspects of the work. And then in your huge places, you know, there are large teams of people who are all responsible for this work at the district level. And then you'll have regional superintendents who are responsible for managing the actual principals. So those regional soups or heads of school report into a superintendent. So, you know, the point is that these organizations make the decisions for a lot of the stuff that an ed tech provider is going to provide. And they're going to have requirements for their district, like you have to integrate with our student information system. You have, you know, either through ClassLink or Clever, one of those. You have to have certain security protocols in place. Some of them will have policies that, you know, can be a little confusing and maybe counterproductive. You have to work with another district in our state, or else we're not going to work with you. Well, what if it's the best thing since sliced bread, and they just haven't happened to work in your state? We shouldn't. You know, a lot of our members would say we shouldn't, dismiss things outright just because they don't yet work in our state. Yet there are procurement policies and rules you got to be mindful of. In some states, it's much easier to work with districts if you have if you go through a process to get vetted and approved by one of the regional educational agencies that report into the State Department. New York State is not New York City, but the rest of New York State is has a kind of pretty famous process through their BOCES, Board of Board of Cooperative Educational Services, BOCES, B-O-C-E-S. And if you have a relationship with one of those agencies, then districts can purchase your stuff on a state contract and they end up saving money because the legislature gives them funds back for using that volume purchasing process. Different states have different relationships around this stuff. The long and short of it is, if a district wants to work with you, they'll help you figure out how to get through the procurement process. And if you're new to a district and new to a state, you're not going to go win an RFP from the jump, usually. That's usually not how it works. RFP is a request for proposal. That's when a district goes out and says, please send us proposals to do these this set of specifications. These documents can be 40, 50 pages long. And typically, that's at the end of a district's kind of research and design process. So they when they come to us, they're like, we got to get better at this one thing, at social emotional learning, at cybersecurity, at, you know, college career readiness, whatever it is, right? And so the IEI companies they're working with to try to kind of explore this new work. And then, you know, they'll typically do a procurement that is most districts have a threshold under which they can, you know, purchase something without having to go through an RFP or get bids or competitive bidding and all that stuff. And so they'll start off with a pilot, quote unquote pilot, where they're buying the solution under the district's, you know, policy for requiring RFPs. And so they try it out. And if it works and it's effective, then the district goes to the next step and they either issue an RFP or they try to do something on a sole source with a provider that, you know, they think has unique ability to provide the solution that no one else can. And then that's just a product of like how the board, you know, wants stuff procured. If the Board of Ed wants everybody over the threshold to go through an RFP, then they're going to require that. If they trust the superintendent and they're okay, you know, saying to the public, we think this is the sole source provider and we don't need to go through an expensive RFP process and review 30 different proposals and have them all come in and present, you know, and that's the relationship between the elected officials on the board and the community. If the community supports them, they're going to say, great, go do your sole source and no one's going to say a word about it. And we get this cool new thing that we all get to use that's going to help our kids at a fair price point. You know, that's how it breaks down. But the RFPs are where you get sort of large volume sales and they can be onerous and difficult and a lot of work. And I don't advise companies to get into that process unless you already have a relationship established or you're already kind of well established as a provider in that region.
And the ed tech decisions, how are they being made underneath the superintendent's team? Is it more a teacher decision or is there like a CTO who's more a chief digital officer who's more like a digital person? How is this done? I believe there must be a lot of stakeholders.
And it's funny, when I was listing all the typical chiefs and deputies under a superintendent, you're reminding me that I forgot the CIO or CTO. There's usually one of those. And then there's also usually somebody who either can be a report to the soup for instructional tech, or they report into a CIO or they report into a chief academic. That's a little more common. And that person is responsible for all of the instructional tech stuff. And they have to kind of work in parallel with the curriculum people. And so, you know, when you say ed tech decisions, like if we're talking ops, we're talking security, we're talking IT, yeah, that's going to fall under a CIO, CTO. The good ones are going to want to go, like if you're going to change our firewall or our single sign-on or something else that's, you know, tech but not program, you know, the good ones will solicit input from the district, get feedback from key stakeholders, convene committees of teachers. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? That's the best process, I think, that ensures buy-in. Because if you're going to ask all these teachers to use something new, you want them on board with it, or else you're going to have a hell of a time getting it actually implemented. So that's a typical process. But But if we're talking about tech that is student facing or teacher facing, if it's curriculum oriented, if it's a learning management, if it's assessment or it's supplemental or core instruction, that almost always is going to run through the academic shop. And the CTO, CIO is going to be there to make sure that it matches protocol and minimum security thresholds, et cetera. But the academic folks will be responsible for making that decision. And again, you'll see a lot of these kind of like, you know, months long processes to review solutions and make choices. And some districts are now going with, you know, here you go. Everybody gets either they issue tokens in the form of district funding to each school or to each grade level or to each classroom. And you can use the stuff on this list and you have a certain budget you can spend. That's a more modern, I think more equitable way to do, you know, school microfinance. But it's not terribly common. Typically it's everybody take a look at this stuff and then we're going to pick one or two providers and based on your input. And that's usually the best way to go.
So you've observed and you've worked in education and you've seen ed tech over the past decade in the States. What do you think is the state of ed tech in schools, be it charter schools, public schools, private schools, homeschoolers, homeschooling pods? Where do you think ed tech is coming from over the past 2 or 3 years, and where are we heading in the next years, budget wise, but also solution wise?
Sure. The big picture, 30,000 foot level, I kind of map to the early 2000s as the beginning of the quote unquote ed tech era. The onset of SaaS, software as a service, really changed all the different kind of solutions that became available to schools. And I think we've spent the last 20 years or so getting better at using them. We're now entering the post-ESSER era. So during the No Child Left Behind era, we saw tons of assessment solutions and curriculum management solutions get deployed because everyone was focused on test scores. We're going to have, you know, then after that, it was, now we have to track during the Race to the Top era, we got to be tracking and working toward improvement, including, you know, all significant subgroups. So we want to make sure our special ed kids, our ELLs, our students of color, all improving at the same level as the rest of, as our general student population, right? So then we were looking at progress monitoring tools, and we really focused on that in the sort of 2010s era. And now we're coming to the ESSER era where we found, and you know, a pandemic showed us that there is appetite for and the possibility of one-to-one instruction driven by student needs, where one teacher can have many different threads of instruction going. But it really didn't, the sort of promise that the industry was providing to schools that, oh yeah, you should be, for years, I think there was a push from Khan Academy on forward, let's just give every kid an individual playlist and then they should be able to do this stuff anywhere. Well, when we had to rip the cord out and pull all the kids off of campuses in March of 2020, we saw how badly that failed. You know, it kept some kids engaged. It was better than nothing, but none of us are going to sit here and say that EdTech delivered a full win in the spring of 2020. But since then, we've made a correction, and this is, you know, my personal take. We've made a correction in terms of how we fund these kinds of initiatives for kids in our districts. We've increased Title I. We've provided specific stimulus funding to help engage students in one-to-one instruction, to help kids who miss time in school, who were struggling behind grade level. And we've seen an onset of new one-to-one instruction providers, a ton of intervention instruction providers, some synchronous, some asynchronous. You can now teach kids, if you love teaching, you can find a job teaching them from your home, from your kitchen, from your basement. And there are many ways for kids to engage with teachers that still keep the classroom teacher as the primary teacher. So we're still going to school in person, yet I can access all of these people to help with one-to-one instruction. It's a teacher's dream, really, to have the ability to get one-to-one tutoring for every kid. That now exists and has been partially boosted by ESSER. You've also got full course providers. So your zip code should no longer determine, the size of your district should no longer determine whether you have certain academic opportunities available to you. All of this is to say, ESSER has propped up a lot of these companies, and districts have gone on, have gone and procured a bunch of stuff. But what happens when that money disappears? There's no indication that the feds are going to keep it going. Some districts are banking this money and using it for the long term. Many are not. And so a lot of the things that everyone's gotten used to may start to disappear. And we're going to see very quickly which companies are built for the long haul and which were flashes in the pan that sought to, you know, make a buck on ESSER, but don't necessarily have the right fit for the long-term marketplace. And that's the state of EdTech right now, is we're waiting to see. It's been, the getting's been really good for a lot of companies, but I think we're going to see a change in district spending now as we kind of settle into the post-pandemic world and we figure out which of these things have delivered on the, you know, higher price points that people have been paying the last couple of years and which haven't. And then we'll see, you know, we'll see a market correction. Maybe some of these providers will be able to stick around by lowering their price and changing their model so that they can fit into the post-ESSER world.
What very much strikes me is this one sentence where you said it's everyone's, every teacher's dream to provide some extra one-on-one tutoring to their kids.
If we can clone ourselves, I was a teacher at one point. If I could have cloned myself, every kid would have probably had a better shot because I could have spent time reviewing each of their writing and, you know, talking with each of them about the conclusions they were drawing in their papers.
See, in Germany and I think in some other countries, we have this very strong tutoring culture where a lot of families take their kids to tutoring centers in the afternoon. And as a teacher in a public school, the tutors sometimes for you, they're like the enemy because they live off your, I say it like this now, they live off your failure. Because you as a state paid teacher have failed in educating your 30 very diverse, very heterogeneous kids. Of course, it's very tough. It's undoable. But still, there's no acceptance that someone else comes and helps your kids out on a one-on-one basis. And so what?
And what about the kids whose parents can't afford to take them to the tutoring center, right? That's what this is all about, is that this is about equity and funding, giving more funding to kids who need more services.
Hmm. So you're saying that there are signs that there might be some project-based, time-based money is going to fade out and this is not going to transfer into some sort of long-term federal funding initiative that's just going to, you know, flush in a few billion every year. It's going to stop at some point.
Well, yeah. I think a lot of us are hoping that it might continue, that this, you know, instead of the narrative being that districts are swelling with cash right now, we believe the narrative is that, well, this is kind of the level at which districts should be funded. And there's still things we could, you know, we could spend more, but this is sort of what we should be doing for our kids, not just leaving it up to the, you know, local tax base. Because if you're from a poor place, the local tax base is never going to be able to afford this on its own. And maybe we should be okay with some districts that need more getting more. That's the true definition of equity.
So true. Thank you, Doug. We've come to an end of our podcast time. That was super insightful, especially the end was, I think, a very powerful statement for everyone who's involved in policy.
All right.
Thank you so much for your time. I hope to interview you again in a few months or years.
Thanks. Wish you all the best. Steph, and I appreciate it. Good talking to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of School Must Go On. For updates and news, you can subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to send me ideas or comments, shoot me an email to podcast@sofatutor.com. I'm also happy to discuss and connect on Twitter and LinkedIn.